So I want to introduce Christopher Strozzes, who's coming to talk to us about cross-border patent enforcement law and practice. And Christopher has a long history of working and practicing in this area of law. He is a partner at Freshfields in London and Dublin, and an experienced litigator, as I said, and has managed cross-border disputes across Europe for over 20 years. He's a legal practitioner, opposition trials before the EPO, and also has acted as a UC representative, including he's also been at the Court of Appeal. Chris has a PhD from Downing College, and for a while he used to do supervisions for Downing and St. Catharines, I think is right. At the moment, he is an honorary professor of practice at University College London, which is a part-time position. And we're very excited to have him here today to tell us something about not just the law, but actually what happens when you try and put it into practice. Thank you.
Thank you for the patience. It was always nice to be back in Cambridge. If we get started, I want to start with this question: what did patents ever do for us? And I thought I'd look up some academic articles talking about what patents ever did for us. Bonus point to be recognized, who wrote the articles. Is IP good for our planet? Does IP improve the world? And then the Snahli entitled, The TRIPS Intellectual Property Waiver Proposal, Creating the Right Incentives in Patent Law and Politics to End the COVID-19 Pandemic. I don't know if there was a payment per word for the title, but that's... And I think often we see, and often if you're studying, you see these articles about how bad IP is, and particularly how bad patents are, and how bad they are for public health, and how they really get in the way of everything. On COVID, maybe just pausing there, on COVID, there is patent litigation over the COVID vaccine. It's happening now. It wasn't happening during the pandemic. It very clearly didn't happen during that pandemic. That litigation is happening in the US, it's happening in Europe. It is not happening in the countries that sometimes were being said to be the ones that were not getting access to medicines because of patents. Your patents weren't the barriers in anywhere, and they certainly weren't the barriers in many countries. And I'll come to a bit to why that is before we get on to how patent litigation actually works. Having said that, this seems slightly with that and being slightly rude about some people's article titles. Patent litigation practice, it's very much about strategic territorial protection. Yes, you can get a patent just about anywhere in the world if you have infinite money and don't care how you spend it. The reality is people don't. Even big, very rich companies will not file, prosecute, and maintain patents all around the world. They will focus on territories where there's manufacturing or territories that are very major markets commercially for the product. Having the right to exclude in a market where there is no market doesn't make sense. Equally, even if there is some degree of market, if you're able to litigate in the bigger markets, often companies will see they will resolve the litigation in those markets and a worldwide deal will follow. And so they don't need to have protection in every country in the world in order to achieve their interest in the patents, in protecting the innovation. And when I talk about the cost, there is a cost in filing a patent, not necessarily very high. Maybe you could do that in lots of countries. There's a cost in prosecuting the patent, so getting the patent to grant. You file the application, you say, I've got this wonderful invention. The response is, it's not so wonderful. What about this? What about that? Back and forth. Doing it in one or two patent offices, okay. Doing that in lots of patent offices in parallel who might come to different decisions, not strategically very wise and expensive. Maintaining a patent. Most countries will require patent annuities. It's often said the first things people set up in a new country are an IP office because of all the annuities you get. More for trademarks, less for patents. But you have to pay every year, every country to maintain a patent. So even in European patents granted by the European Patent Office, which are granted for many countries, the first thing I do when I'm litigating a patent is get my get a copy of the patent and cross out all the countries that are no longer in force, which is normally 80% of them. So even within the EP, because it doesn't cost any more to grant, but it does cost to maintain. It also costs to some countries still cost to translate. And so all of these costs on an individual patent, if you knew it was worth mega billions, maybe you would say it was worth it. But companies file often tens, hundreds, thousands of patents. They've got a huge portfolio. You multiply those numbers up, it just doesn't make sense. So it's cost prohibitive, protect everywhere. The reality is patent owners focus on the countries where it makes sense to have their patents. Okay. But that still leads to duplicative litigation. So yes, it's narrowed. It's not every country in the world. But you will still have it for multiple countries, and that can lead to the same case, the same issues being litigated in different countries. And people look at that and say, well, that seems wasteful. If it's the same kind of issue, or really the same issue, the same evidence, the same prior art being cited against a patent, couldn't you just have one court deciding that? Wouldn't that make sense? Wouldn't that be a more efficient way? It's hugely inefficient. And we may get different results in different countries. And that's why we end up with litigation in different countries. The patent owner will say, well, I've got patents here, here, and here. This looks like the one that's going to get me the best advantage because I'm going to get an injunction and force them to do a deal. Maybe the other side says, no, I'm going to sue in this country because that court is likely to revoke the patent and tell them it's rubbish. And then I'll go around to tell the courts, look what Rich Garner's done, or whichever judge maybe has revoked the patent. So you have this strategic litigation then occurs within that limited pool of countries where the patent is granted. The patent owner and the potential defendant will often choose, and they will choose one or more different countries. And that can be because the initial benefits, or it can be because, well, we think in the process of litigation in this country, this is going to happen. That is going to damage their ability to maintain another country. And so there's a timing issue often of it. But all very complex, all get very expensive. If you think the portfolio cost of patents is bad, look at litigating any particular patent. So what do the courts think about this? And I've really focused on the English court's decisions on this. This is from Willie Aldous back in 1995. For myself, I would not welcome the task of having to decide whether a person had infringed a foreign patent. Why does he not fancy that? Well, it's because it concerns the public. It's not just about the parties. The finding of infringement is the finding of monopoly granted by the state is to be enforced. And so the public in that country have to pay higher prices than if that monopoly didn't exist. And if that decision, he says, that should come from the court situated in the state where the public have to pay the higher prices. One only has to imagine the decision of this court. The German public should pay to a British company substantial sums of money to realize the difficulties that might arise. As we'll see as we go on, he knew what he was talking about, but 30 years on, this is where we're now getting. That's my slight spoiler alert. So we've got 1995. I don't like the idea of doing it. Also, even worse if validity is an issue, because validity really has to be decided whether the court is granted, and that's everyone kind of accepts the validity. As a matter of against the world, has to be decided in the country where the patent has been granted. As if validity is so intertwined, at least from an English court standpoint, English law standpoint, with infringement, that if you're going to be forced to decide validity in England, then England should also be deciding infringement. And that should be for each country for the patents that are in that country. So that's a very much country by country. Yes, I love the idea. Maybe we could have one court deciding multiple, but it's not going to work because validity has to be decided country by country. Infringement's entangled. And anyway, there is a public policy problem with giving an injunction in a country, forcing prices up in a country, if it's not the country where the court is based. So that's what we have. Luddy moves things on a little bit in coin controls, and coin controls is often the case that's cited about how bad the British courts are. It's all Luddy's fault. So he agrees with Willie Aldous that we have always taken the view you cannot infringe an invalid patent. But he goes on to say, But I don't know in any particular case, we don't know whether validity will be challenged. And this was in circumstances where the English courts were having to work out what to do with the Brussels Convention, the Brussels Regulation, which establishes jurisdiction within the European Union. And on the face of that, parties should be sued. They should be sued in their place of domicile. So you know, that's a fundamental basis. You've got to sue a party in their own home court. That works well for lots of issues. Challenge where it clashes with IP, where you've got the validity needing to be decided in the place the patent's granted, which may not be the domicile of the defendant. So how does he come to terms with that? What he says, well, let's see, if validity is challenged in due course, then that means maybe the court needs to reject jurisdiction, but until then it can decide. So I don't have such a problem. I don't have this quite the same fundamental problem as Willie Alderson saying, I can never do it. But I wait to see what happens in validity. And if validity comes in, well, okay, if validity comes in, it's game over. So Brussels Convention may force me, I don't really like it, may force me to decide for infringement. But as soon as validity comes up, and you know, it's quite a safe bet because in just about every single case in the English courts, if an infringement of patent is raised, then validity comes up. So yes, theoretically, it could be an infringement on the case. It's too complex to separate them. It's so close interrelated. So for jurisdiction purposes, once validity comes up, that's game over. So that's Laddie a couple of years later. And then we had the Fort Dodge case. Fort Dodge, Axel bringing a case in the Netherlands. We'll see the Netherlands comes up quite often. The Netherlands like cross-border jurisdiction for infringement of an EP. And Fort Dodge came to the English Patent Court seeking revocation. But Axel's action covered the UK patent. English Patents Court, Laddie J, once again, granted an anti-suit injunction. It said validity is being raised in relation to the UK patent. It shouldn't be considered in there and I'll grant an interim injunction. The Court of Appeal confirmed both the Pierce case, what it was copyright case rather than a patents case. You can sue in the place of domicile for IP infringement, but also coin controls. Once validity is raised, game over. But said this is an act clair, so we got to send that to the ECJ to find out whether we're right and how that works. And we're a little more conciliatory than it was just Sladdy. They wouldn't give an interim anti-suit injunction because we've every confidence the Dutch courts will, in deciding what to do, take into account that we made a reference to the ECJ, i.e., let's all be sensible. We don't need to be getting anti-suits against each other's courts because we'll all be sensible. Of course, the ECJ didn't decide that the case was withdrawn, the case settled. But eventually we got some clarity. We had Turner and Grovet, which says between countries in the European Union, you shouldn't be anti-suiting each other. You should be more respectful of each other and not granting anti-suits. And I say of each other, an anti-suit injunction isn't an injunction against a court. An anti-suit injunction is against the parties telling them not to proceed before the court. Hugely respectful of the court, but the parties can't continue anyway. And then we got more clarity, sort of, on how the Brussels regulation worked. We had Gatton, Luck and Roche and Primus in 2006, which essentially went along with the view in coin controls. They once validity is in play, the case is stuck in the country where the case has to be done country by country. Solvay and Honeywell, another Dutch approach of trying to go cross-border, saying, well, what if it's an interim injunction? That's not subject to the same restrictions in the Brussels regulation. It's only an interim injunction. And the reference explained that the Dutch court would consider whether there was a non-negligible possibility that the right court would invalidate the patent and would only go ahead and give an interim injunction or preliminary injunction if there was no non-negligible possibility. So if there's any chance the right court would revoke, we're not going to go there. But if validity is hopeless, then maybe we can go ahead, even though validity is nominally in play. That seemed to be what was before. The Dutch courts are very quick to not mention that bit of the decision afterwards when they've been applying the case. But that was what sort of halts off in Honeywell. And the ECJ recognized that that's what it had been told when it said, yes, for interim injunctions, you can go ahead. It's not subject to the same absolute ban. But now we have the BSH case from last year. BSH and Electrolux, it's a pre-Brexit case. It doesn't really impact in the UK directly. It was a case in Sweden, and there the defendant was being sued for all the European patent, EPO patents, including one in Turkey. And one of the big questions was, is the Swedish court able to decide for the Turkish patent, or is it not? So the validity was a question being raised. And what the ECJ decided in that case, it was a very odd case. It was originally heard by a chamber. The chamber then had a bit of a challenge with the case. It was referred to the Grand Chamber, who partially reheard the case. I went to that hearing, Luxembourg. I'm not convinced they got all the arguments put before them, but anyway, they heard what they heard. And they've really rolled back on those restrictions and now say, well, actually, is okay to go ahead, provided that your decision on validity is only on an inter partes basis. We're not going to step in the territory of any court and say that the patent is invalid against all comers, but we'll decide as between the parties on validity. And we can do that both, we can't really do that within the EU, but maybe the Brussels regulation change allow that. But outside the EU, no restrictions. We won't decide validity against the world, but we will decide validity inter partes. Many people weren't really watching that case or thinking it wouldn't be very important. I was, and it was clearly going to be an important case. And we'll come back to what impact that has had. But up to that point, the EU was quite calm, and it was country by country patent litigation. You can't really go beyond it very often. There had to be unusual circumstances where validity wasn't an issue. That didn't mean anti-suit injunctions and respect for territorial jurisdiction didn't apply elsewhere. We had the IPCOM Lenovo case in the UK. This is about the US. Sorry for the very nice flags in the corner, just to help see where we are. So in that case, Lenovo brought a FRAND case against IPCOM in the United States. What's a FRAND case? A case to decide what is a fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory license. And those arise in relation to standards, where in order to bring patents into standards, the participants to the standard organization have to agree they will not exclude parties, but they will grant licenses typically on a FRAND basis. So Lenovo go against IPCOM in the US, IPCOM go against Lenovo in the UK and France, saying, can we have a determination of patent infringement? And they were very clear what they were after. They wanted an early determination, and the US got to decision on FRAND, trying to put pressure on Lenovo to agree terms sooner, and just in case the US court didn't settle FRAND. Lenovo didn't like this, sought an anti-suit injunction in the US against the continuation of the UK and French proceedings. IPCOM came to the UK and said, can we have an anti-suit injunction? Stop the US court stopping the UK and French courts from proceeding. Lenovo tried to accelerate the US determination. IPCOM then got an injunction to allow the UK to hear the anti-suit injunction first, and IPCOM obtained an anti-suit injunction in relation to the UK companies to say, no, the UK court can go ahead. The US court shouldn't block this. So this was in relation to the UK patent. Though the US court might be deciding FRAND issues generally, we should be allowed to go ahead. Not sure that's quite what the UK court believes now, but that time that was what the UK court believed. SES and World Programming, probably a case you come across on the copyright side, but there was an interesting piece there as well. Lots of messy litigation. SES sued WPL in the UK, copyright infringement and breach of contract, and also in the US, copyright infringement, breach of contract and fraud. WPL went to the US and said foreign nonconvenience. That challenge failed. SES proceeded to lose in the UK, but won in the US on the breach of contract and the fraud claims. They came to the UK court trying to enforce that US judgment. The UK courts were having none of it. So they decided to try to enforce in the UK against debts owed internationally. So they went to the US court saying, can we have enforcement of our judgment, including any debts owed in the UK? WPL came to the UK court saying, and got an ex parte anti-suit injunction saying you shouldn't be allowed to do that because we decided on it. That was overturned inter partes. The court went to the Court of Appeal and said that attempt to enforce was markedly exorbitant, as enforcement must be territorial. You shouldn't be enforcing in other countries, not IP, but enforcement. And some slightly rude comments about what was happening in the US. The argument of the Law's Committee, you should be respectful of the other courts. Committee will be of less weight where the order made by the foreign court involves a breach of customary international law, and it's a two-way street requiring respect, mutual respect between the courts. So they didn't give an anti-suit injunction against everything, but said, to the extent you're trying to enforce in the UK, no, you can do that. We'll give an anti-suit injunction. So that's where we get to in the US. China also has a part to play. Philips brought a Fran case against Xiaomi in the UK and obtained an anti-suit injunction to prevent Xiaomi from starting proceedings in China to frustrate the UK court's jurisdiction. So Philips, worried about an anti-suit injunction for the Chinese courts, obtained a preemptive anti-suit injunction to stop that happening. The parties compromised the application. The terms of the compromise are confidential, so we don't know exactly what happened. But the court, slightly cheekily, I think, the following year noted, so far as Philips is aware, Xiaomi has not since brought proceedings in China seeking to frustrate this court's jurisdiction. So not clear what terms they settled, but it looks like the terms were, we want to seek an anti-suit injunction from China. Similarly, Philips and Oppo, Philips brought a Fran case against Oppo in the UK and said they came for an anti-suit in light of the previous anti-suit injunction obtained by Oppo and Sharp and Oppo, which killed German infringement proceedings. That was granted ex parte in the UK. Oppo came to the court and said, this is ridiculous. We haven't done that since that case, and we've no intention of doing so. We'll challenge jurisdiction in the seized court. We're not going to be running off to the Chinese court seeking an anti-suit injunction. The court maintained, even inter partes, maintained the anti-suit injunction, but limited its scope a little so that Chinese rate-setting proceedings, the kind of proceedings to determine Fran could proceed, but they couldn't be allowed to block the UK infringement proceedings. So that's where we get to. Now, everyone doing a slide deck talking about current events has to have a compulsory Brexit slide. So there's my compulsory Brexit slide. One of the big changes with Brexit is the Brussels regulation no longer applies in the UK. Turner and Grover no longer applies. So suddenly, it's not just China and the US the UK court might have to go against. It's the courts around Europe. So what happens? Well, funnily enough, the Dutch courts very quickly post-Brexit get back in the game, and Boston sues Cook in the Netherlands for infringement of a UK patent. Cook comes to the UK court and said, please, can we have an anti-suit injunction? And Cook says, and we're worried, while you're considering an anti-suit injunction, that there might be an anti-suit injunction from the Netherlands court. So please, can we have an anti-suit injunction to stop the anti-suit injunction before you can decide whether we should get an anti-suit injunction? Everyone gets very excited about how many A's you can put before this suit injunction. The court didn't give an anti-suit, but they ordered Boston to give 72 hours notice of any application for an anti-suit injunction. So they didn't decide it, but said, tell us if you're going to do it. And it's pretty obvious the court would have granted an anti-suit if they'd come in doing that. And ultimately, Boston did not pursue the long arm rule from the Netherlands. They decided not to get into this fight. There are pages and pages. I think you'll get the slides afterwards. I'm not going to read through everything, but Mead bends over backwards on comedy. He's very clear to say, right, in the past, we didn't do anti-suit injunctions against each other. It's no longer prohibited, but we have to be very careful before getting into this anti-suit business. We shouldn't be doing it. This echoes the comment earlier about the German courts. I'm sure in saying that in due course, if and when the courts of the Netherlands look at the current case, they will want to take comity into consideration as well, and refers to the point of solving Honeywell and the British favourite point of it, which is the reasonable, non-negligible possibility. So I'm sure the Dutch court, when they look at it, will not go ahead and grant a preliminary injunction if there's any chance we might revoke the patent. I'm sure they'll be sensible. And then goes on and on and on, explaining how the why are we shutting down? Not sure why we're shutting down. One second.
Too heavy.
Yeah, solved it. So saying it goes on to explain comity will be important for the Dutch courts. And I'm sure that if the parallel situation ever arose in the UK, our courts would exercise the same care and restraint. So I'm sure the Dutch courts will be sensible. I'm sure we'll be sensible too. Can't we all be sensible? And so he goes on to say, I've reached the conclusion it's at least arguable there may be an anti-suit injunction, but we'd have to be careful and we really shouldn't be rushing into it. And maybe there's got other points to be raised. The making of such an injunction cannot be taken because maybe the Dutch courts will be all very sensible. And if the Dutch courts are all very sensible, maybe the same argument will be done in the Dutch courts and we needn't get into there. There's pages of this, really. Certainly paragraphs of it. So that's the UK courts. The UK court has... Sorry, I've just flipped one slide. One other decision by Mr. Justice Mead. Texas Instruments, NST. NST had sought in the new unified patent court, a long arm claim, a claim for damages under the UK designations. That's been corresponded. Three bases had been put forward why the UK court should expedite the UK case. And one is that we should be using the UK judgment to influence long arm claim for damages. And then rapidly, NST said, okay, actually, we're not going to go for the... We don't want the UK courts expedited. We're not going to pursue relief. And I'm grateful for the sensible and pragmatic concession that long-arm relief wouldn't be sought. So again, not saying you can't seek long-arm, not saying it's outrageous, not saying I'll give an anti-suit injunction, but regards to the sensible and pragmatic that they don't seek relief for UK patents, once again, in this case in the UPC rather than in the Dutch courts. So what's happening in the EU while everyone is being awfully sensible? Here's some headlines. The first one is about the BSH case. You've been going to Justice Letts Court to rule an infringement of US, UK, other foreign patents subject to defendant's domicile. And then not long after, the UPC, which seems to have taken this as a challenge, the Düsseldorf Local Division assumes long-arm jurisdiction over UK part of an EPO-granted patent. And then the Mannheim Local Division enters the first ever UPC injunction relating to the UK in the Fujifilm and Kodak case. I'll declare an interest. I'm involved in the Fujifilm and Kodak case. Both of those, the second and third judgments, are both in relation to the same set of the same parties, different patents, one before the Düsseldorf Local Division and one before the Mannheim Local Division. So at the same time as we're having Mr. Justice Mead saying we're all going to be sensible, aren't we? We have the UPC getting very excited and granting long arm relief. And the UPC is limited to deciding on European patents. The other European courts aren't solicited. And one of the points we made is what's going to happen if what, not the UPC, but one of the other national courts does this for a UF patent? What do you think the US reaction is going to be? Well, we got to see that. You know, some clever German lawyers had a similar idea. Anesta sued BMW in a Munich regional court over two US and one European patent. Funnily enough, the US gave Dan an anti-suit injunction saying, no, we can't. You can't do that. That's subject to appeal. And the understanding is that there is a settlement agreed between Anesta and Qualcomm, which will cover BMW. At the moment, there's a spat going before the Federal Circuit in the US as to whether the appeal should be turned down because of the settlement or whether the appeal should be put on ice with the extensions of time granted until the settlement takes place. Not matter. We need to get into the detail of, but we're seeing that so it's not just a EU versus the UK battle here. The BSH case opens it up for everyone. So up to this point, I would hope you would agree that the UK courts are being very nice, sensible, and balanced. And it's these terrible European courts that are going wild. But that's when we have to say, don't mention the interim license. If you want to get any German judge or UPC judge exploding at the moment, do mention interim license. But unless you really want to see that, I would recommend you don't do it. Same blog, IP Frey. Interim license imperialism. Lord Justice Arnold becomes a threat to UK relations with the United States, Europe, other countries and regions. Very excitable coverage. This comes from the Panasonic Xiaomi case. So talk about what is interim license relief and why are people getting so excited about it? Now, the English courts since Unwired Planet, which went all the way up to the Supreme Court, have said, when deciding whether it's an infringement of a UK patent, we can decide what the terms of a FRAND license would be as part of that case. And the FRAND license is worldwide. So we will say, you promise to give a FRAND license, and what the UK court says, we will give an injunction unless. We will only give an injunction if this FRAND license is not taken out. So they give the licensee the ability to get a license on terms that it will set. Because the problem with a FRAND obligation is, I promise I will grant you a license on fair, reasonable, non-discriminatory terms. Doesn't tell you how you decide those terms. So one person's FRAND terms may not be another person's FRAND terms. So you constantly baffle where the term should be 100 million. No, the term should be 1 million. How do you decide that? And there really is two schools of thought. The English court's approach, it has been FRAND injunction. I will decide what the terms are, and you only get your injunction if the licensee won't take one of them out. But if you refuse to grant the license, or they do take out license on those terms, I'm not granting an injunction. So the compelling force is there'll be a UK injunction, but UK courts will tell you what the license is. So that's one school of thought. The other school of thought is the Brits are crazy. This is far too expensive and complex. I'll tell you how you get it to resolve these disputes. You give an injunction unless they've reached a sensible FRAND license by the time it gets to court. And that's the German court's approach. The German courts will still give injunctions. They won't give an injunction if there's a proper, a willing licensee. There are various kind of numbers get bandied around, but basically you're never a willing licensee in the German courts. The German courts will almost always give an injunction. And if you've not got a license by that stage, well, you've got to take a license or leave the German market. Yeah, and we've seen some companies leaving the German market as a result, but most companies can't afford to do that. So they're forced to take a license at that stage if they haven't done so. So German court approach, very pragmatic, very quick, cheaper. English court approach will get what the right answer is, Fran, and tell you. And then you can decide what you're going to do about that. That then leads to a race of the courts, because the English courts will take some time to decide an interim license. German courts can decide an injunction pretty quickly, particularly when it's unwilling, so they can really get a crack on with that. The response to that in the English courts was, wait a second, why don't we look at what an interim license look at? Because if you're really a fair, reasonable, non-discriminatory, you ought to grant an interim license. So we can work out what that is. So the conclusion in this case was that there would be. So the court found that Panasonic was in breach of its obligations of good faith by pursuing claims for injunctions to foreign courts, Germany, despite having invoked the jurisdiction of the English court to determine FRAND terms, and despite both parties having undertaken that they would agree to the terms. So in this case, both parties had agreed they would abide by what the UK court decided. But still, Panasonic was going off seeking injunctions elsewhere to try and speed up the process. The English courts thought that was beyond the pale. And they found that a willing licensor in the position of Panasonic would enter into an interim license with Germany. And FRAND terms of that license would be those set out in the preceding paragraphs. The English court said, what would an interim license look like? I'm not forcing you to enter. I'm not telling you have to enter an interim license. But if you're willing, you would. Query what impact that has. That was clearly meant to have an impact on the foreign courts. Query what impact, and the foreign courts, I think, have said not very much. But it's not an interim license that's granted. It's, as Monty Python might put it, it's just a very naughty declaration that is being granted. So it's a declaration that is meant to influence the foreign courts, but they've not actually granted the license. If they granted the license and that license was binding on foreign courts, then they clearly wouldn't be able to give an injunction. But it's a declaration at that stage. A lot of talk about comity. Xiaomi said that the courts of this jurisdiction should respect the ability of courts such as the German National Courts and the UPC to decide issues falling within their national competencies. And so you shouldn't be granting an interim license. You shouldn't really be interfering unless there are proper grounds for an absolute injunction. And the judge said the only useful purpose to make a declaration would be to influence the outcome of the German proceedings. and that be contrary to comity. And the judge, that this is Rich Darlin, the Court of Appeal. If that premise were concerned, he would agree with the judge. But he said, if the declarations do induce Panasonic to reconsider its position and to grant Germany an interim license, that will brought comity because it would relieve the German courts and the UPC of a great deal of burdensome and a waste of litigation. If ever a paragraph was written that's like to wind up foreign courts, I think it's that paragraph. I don't think it's intended to wind up the foreign courts, but it clearly has, because they shouldn't have to worry their pretty heads about deciding these patent cases when the English courts can decide them for them. And he goes on to say, well, it's up to the German courts what to do with the declarations anyway. It's just the declaration. What's the big deal? Comity is not a reason not to grant the declaration. So I'm still letting the other courts do, and I'm being nice because we're helping the foreign courts not have to decide these difficult patent cases. That was a slightly interesting case because in that case, both parties agreed ultimately to be bound by what the English courts did. They'd gone into it. The only question was, could Panasonic then and say, while we're waiting, let's get some injunctions elsewhere and see if we can speed up this process. The other cases were distinguished. But we get this series of interim license declarations. The Alcatel Nokia Amazon case. The English courts are very good, or the English lawyers are very good at spotting what other people are doing, and if it looks like a good idea, copying it. So we have a whole series of people amending cases or filing new cases with a claim for an interim license, and thank you very much. In that case, Amazon tried to amend an existing case to receive such a declaration. Nokia said, well, this is different. We didn't start the SEP case in the UK. We didn't consent to UK giving RAND terms. And anyway, the terms would only cover some of the patents. I think many from outside thought, well, the court may well see that as different. You know, it's one thing if everyone's agreed it's got sort of the air, you're just trying to short circuit. It's another if there's a big squabble about whether the UK court should be decided this in the first place. The licensee can't necessarily come to the UK court saying, please can you decide and can you stop them deciding anywhere else? Can we get the UK court to seize jurisdiction? Court of Appeal said, real prospect distinctions and material. We'll go ahead. That's deciding whether you allow the case to be amended. It's not really deciding the case. It's just that there's a real prospect, so they'll allow the amendment in. Lenovo and Ericsson was one step further. Ericsson's tried to distinguish from Panasonic. There were differences in that case too. But the English court said, well, I don't really care so much about the differences. You're still seeking injunctions overseas to extract super friend terms. So that the reason you're doing this, rather than waiting for the UK, or even though you didn't want to come to the UK, we're going to decide it anyway. It's the only reason once we're going to decide it for you to do it elsewhere is to get above friend terms. That's not good enough. Therefore, same answer as Panasonic. We will grant an interim license. And now we've got quite a lot of clarity on how interim licenses are granted. Samsung ZTE was the lawyers being clever trying to push it a bit too far. In that case, ZTE wanted FRAN to be determined in China. Samsung wanted it to be decided in the UK. In that case, the court said, well, okay, this is different because they're no longer trying to get super FRAN terms. They're just trying to have their jurisdiction of choice rather than your jurisdiction of choice. That's no bad. That's not bad faith. And so there's a real comity concern in that case. And in that case, the Chinese court was going to decide it before the English court. So there wasn't even a, this would be a faster way of doing it. This was simply, we think the courts have come to different decisions. The English court said, well, that's not a good enough reason. One thing if you're trying to game the system, another thing if you're just trying to choose, have your jurisdiction of choice. This was also in the face of a lot of complaints from around the world that the UK courts were being extraterritorial and not paying attention to comity. So those were the next three cases, interim license declaration. Pretty gung-ho by the UK courts, but a point at which they said, okay, yet we'll grant interim licenses, but not in every, and we're not going to block the Chinese courts deciding FRAND. Yeah. And then we get to nobody expecting the Swiss-specific enforcement. So the cases up to now have been under different provisions, and those and ETSI provisions, which are the FRAND ones, previous cases, are under French law. But the ITU, different standard setting body, subject to Swiss law. Swiss law is interesting because Swiss law, at least according to some of the parties, gives a right to specific enforcement. So now I'm no longer just interested in a declaration. Now I like to come to the English court and say, dear English court, you're Caesar this case. You're applying Swiss law. Swiss law allows you to specifically enforce a contract. So I can actually get an interim license granted by you. Not just a declaration. I would like an interim license, please, because you're allowed to do that because it's under Swiss law. That came up in the Alcatel Nokia case. And the interim license trial was due to be heard in April 2025, but the case settled in April 2025. So it didn't get decided in that case. But it, when, again, people saw it happening, thought, that's a clever idea. Let's try that with our Swiss cases. So there've been a series of these now with Acer, Hisense, Asus. They were all decided by Ms. Justice Meller. We had InterDigital and Amazon leading to a series of anti-suit injunctions and pretty vitriolic stuff in Germany, the UPC, and the UK. At one point, the German judges saying, this anti-suit injunction saying that anyone assisting breaching it could be in contempt of court and thrown in jail. Does that apply to us as the judges? And to be fair to them, when you look at the terms doesn't say except for judges. There's no exclusion, even though all the English lawyers would, I think, typically say, no, that can't be what it means. But they're reading at the face and we're saying, does that mean we can't travel to the UK anymore? There are contempt motions. It's getting very nasty, that case. Warner Brothers and Nokia, anti-suit injunctions granted by Meller and Paramount and Nokia. There's just this series of cases. It's really blowing up in this world. We had in Warner Brothers and Nokia, this is Justice Meller, said he hadn't completed his judgment in the first one, but he says, my hope and expectation is what I say in that judgment will, if upheld in appeal, modify the practice in relation to interim licenses declarations following the sentiments in Samsung ZTE and serve to reduce the degree of conflict with the German national and GPC courts. We're trying to de-escalate. He went ahead and granted the interim license. I'm not sure how much that's going to de-escalate. Other thoughts, and this is just a flavor of what was going on in the Amazon InterDigital. We had Ms. Justice Mead saying, I have a real degree of concern about the evidence that was given by InterDigital and the arguments they made. So InterDigital going to the German court saying, this terrible thing will happen in the UK courts if you don't grant an anti-suit injunction or an anti-interim license injunction. Very critical of what had happened there. One of the criticisms saying, we wouldn't do it ex parte. You know, we would give the parties a chance to be heard. About 2 weeks later, the English court, same judge, granted an ex parte anti-suit injunction to protect its jurisdiction over the final decision. So what had happened was the UPC and the German courts had given an anti-interim license injunction. So they blocked the English court's ability to give an interim license, but on its face still allowed the English courts to go and grant decide a final license. They just couldn't grant this interim license. There was some doubt as to whether InterDigital would either say that covered the final decision or whether they would go back to the German UPC court and say, can you also give one against that final decision? Because we don't like cross-border decision-making. You shouldn't be doing that either. Amazon went into the judge ex parte so that without InterDigital knowing, saying, we're worried about them doing this. And having made a big fuss about the English courts don't do things like that ex parte, then granted ex parte. It came back into parties. But we're getting into this really big spat. We had, again, the UK judges love to think that human nature is good. I have a suspicion the recent experience of Amazon InterDigital litigation might have had a chastening effect on the representatives acting for InterDigital. This was in a case when InterDigital was not involved, but the same law firm was involved. The judges have been careful not to name, but everyone knows who the law firm is and who the partners are involved there are. I mentioned this at the conference in Brussels last year, knowing quite well the individual personalities about whether they'd be chastened or not. They do not seem particularly chastened by what has happened, because people think that they are right. And the courts, particularly the UPC and German courts at the moment, are very much involved in that. In the Acer, Hisense Asus case, when it went back in Germany, there are paragraphs in that judgment about, well, the English courts know better. They know they're not allowed to do this in this cross-border relief, and they shouldn't be doing it, and they know it's outside their jurisdiction. So there's a big debate at the moment, a dialogue between the courts going through in fairly stringent terms in the judgments. So having started with his IP good and his IP good for the wild and so on, gone through how does patent litigation work? It used to work in a very sensible, balanced way. It might be quite inefficient, but it was country by country and you didn't have these anti-suit battles. We have now got into major anti-suit battle territory. I haven't talked about the EU's case against China and these ongoing cases against China on anti-suit injunctions. The EU says what China's doing on anti-suit injunctions is outrageous. The UK's popped up there saying, so bad is it? Because the UK is doing the same thing. So we are in a really dynamic, changing piece. So what was already quite interesting of how you manage cross-border litigation, how you resolve these disputes, is now got this new complexity. It's been driven a bit by Brexit. It's been driven a bit by the VSH decision of the ECJ. There's a lot of talk of de-escalation. The word de-escalation has probably appeared more in these judgments in the last 6 months than I've ever seen it before. But there doesn't seem to be a lot of actual de-escalation happening so far. And with that, just about on time, I will stop and take any questions.